We started to talk about this in the previous chapter. It says, what sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Again, I stress, you know, as we go through these chapters, we're learning, we're trying to come to some conclusions. So we want to keep thinking of our own experiences. As, you know, as my sponsor shared his experiences, I was encouraged to think about my experience so I could identify with him and come to my conclusions. Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he do it? Of what is he thinking? This is our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He has a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see. That's one of the examples Brian gave us in There is a Solution. Except for a nervous disposition. I like how they call our problem a nervous disposition. Or in another story, case of the jitters. This is early on. You know, other people and ourselves are making excuses for us. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated, he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, today we do the treatment centers, or we can run right to AA if we don't need to be detoxed, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism, so what they did was they talked with him. As the book lays out, they gained his confidence enough, and they laid out the problem and the program of action for him. It says, we told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. And now it was up to him. Once they do that, you know, an alcoholic can't go any farther unless, again, they're willing to continue pursuing the program of action. So he said he made a beginning. Now, we don't know exactly what that means, to what point he made his beginning. It says his family is reassembled. So now we also see that he used to have this business, and he used to have a family. So obviously, they don't say to what degree he lost everything, but it sounds like he lost a lot going into that before going into the asylum. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. His family was reassembled. He began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. So we see he lost his business already. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. So to whatever degree he made a beginning, what they're stressing is he just didn't continue on that path. And he sounds like what happened to me. I started to feel a little better. I started to gain a little bit of knowledge. Bill says over and over in this book, self-knowledge will avail us nothing. I started to gain a little bit of knowledge, and then I started to run my life again, and just what happened here, you know, I'm lucky I didn't go out and drink. I ended up finding some people who did the big book. You know, but this guy had to go out and drink again. And it all went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. In each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. So they would help him to see where his thinking, which preceded the first drink. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had deep affection. So he did understand to some degree what his problem was. But again, if we see that he doesn't possess the ability to make that choice. He doesn't really see that yet. Yet, because on the next page, 36, yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. And this is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. And I like that. I didn't notice that for a long time either. Tuesday morning. That's the reason I was self-employed. I could go to work whenever I wanted. I remember I felt irritated that I had been a salesman for a concern I once owned. I mean, he words this very nicely, but I would have been pissed. You know, I would have been consumed every time I saw that man with hate and self-seeking thoughts, and I know driven by fear, but So he puts it rather nicely. He said, I felt irritated. I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they had a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I had the notion that I might find a customer for a car in this place. You know, all along, if you look at that kind of thinking, what he's going for, you know what I mean? Today I know I don't have any business going to a bar to have a sandwich. There's just no reason for me to do that. But again, we can see all these things that his thinking is still thinking in the old terms and along his line. His self-will is telling him what's right and what's wrong. The whole point of this story is that when he's sitting here, he's got this sandwich and he orders a glass of milk. So I sat down at the table to order a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Well, see, again, there's a little strange something's going on which he doesn't see. But suddenly, this is what Brian was talking about, the italic writing. So suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. It doesn't sound normal to me. I mean, you know, today I understand it, you know. I don't know that I really understood it, again, that clearly back then, but the point they're making is that this is that lack of sane thinking. You know, over on page 37, at the bottom of page 36, it says, he had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if he only mixed it with milk. You know, and again, Brian, you know, in his example, you know, of describing his thinking there, you know, it our minds all of a sudden said, oh, yeah, that's right, you know. We couldn't differentiate the truth from the false. Because whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion, the inability to think straight, be called anything else? Because when you think, you may think this case extreme to us, it is not far-fetched. For this kind of thinking has been characterized by every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always that curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. That's why I talk about that obsession. I think of it in me as the river, you know, and my mind would use, and it was a driving force, and it was pushing me to just create all the truth so it would get me to pick up the drink. Those were all the trivial excuses. Well, I think what we're going to do, well, the rest of this chapter, there's another example called the jaywalker, you know, which, again, his insane thinking kept getting him to do something. The next story is Fred. These are all real important stories that it's not really important to go through right now. The point about this chapter is it lays out a number of examples to allow us to see the thinking that precedes the first drink, and it gives us enough so we can start to identify with that in ourselves. I think what we're going to do is we're going to just go on, because I would suggest that you read those, you know, and it'll help you to identify that in you. I think what we're going to do is, because I think we're right on time now, we're going to start in on We Agnostics, Brian.
Okay. Let's see. We Agnostics starts on page 44. And the very first paragraph on this chapter is fairly interesting. It's also has the idea that you've read the preceding chapters, because it says, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. That's some of the information that we've been reading up to this point, is to make these ideas clear what the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic is. And Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. I read an article in the, I think it's U.S. News and Report or something like that. It was a title page article. The cover story said, AA, what they don't want you to know. And I thought, well, that's an interesting lead-in for a big national magazine. You know, what is this secret that AA doesn't want you to know? So I started reading the story, and of course it was written by somebody that had very little familiarity with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what they were going on to say is that Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to tell you that you can't drink alcohol. And they were saying that there's lots of people that just need to limit their intake. And, of course, we're not one of them. I mean, we're real alcoholics. We're not trying to give a program for people who just would like to cut down on their drinking. When this isn't about moderate drinkers. It's not about, heavy drinkers. It's about alcoholics. That's what we're about. So that's the whole distinction we're trying to make. And here's what my sponsor pointed out as a very good definition to what an alcoholic is, the next sentence. Because I've been in AA for a year and a half prior to this, and I was still wondering, you know, what is an alcoholic? And here's the definition he pointed out to me. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Now, what's that talking about? That's talking about the insanity that precedes the first drink. That's the idea of when you're deciding to quit, like Bill Wilson did in his story, when he finally decided that this is it, I've got to stop. He found he couldn't. It's the first step when it says, it says, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. Now what that sentence is referring to in my feeling is the first step where it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. To me that means we can't drink. That's the problem. We can't drink. And then the second part of the solution, the statement says that our lives had become unmanageable. That means we will drink. That's what that means. We will. We possess the insanity that precedes the first drink. And that's what that definition is talking about. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, means that your life is unmanageable. Or if when you're drinking, you have little control over the amount you drink, that's the physical phenomenon of craving, that's the part where we're powerless over alcohol, if you have both those components, then you're an alcoholic. And it says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And what happened to the guys that David was just talking about in more about alcoholism, guys like Jim and Fred anyway, those two guys, those stories, both of them, if you look through there, you'll notice that both those guys were approached by Alcoholics Anonymous people. And they told them about this phenomenon of craving. They told them about the insanity that preceded the first drink. And they understood it, but they said, I don't think I'm quite as bad as you. I don't think I really need the spiritual experience. I think I'll be able to get along just nicely knowing the information. And what they found out was that it didn't work. And that's when the Alcoholics Anonymous guys come back to them, and they said they were smiling like they didn't like it too much. And and then they said, so what do you think now? Do you think you're suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer? And that's what they both admitted, and remained sober after that. So now on page 45 in the book, in We Agnostics, it has some nice information right there in the middle of the page. It tells us that, you know, we're powerless over alcohol. So it says, lack of power, that is our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? How are we going to get the power now that we figured out we're powerless? Well, it says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. That's the main purpose of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So now this chapter, We Agnostics, is really, I guess, addressed to people like myself who are agnostic or atheist. And it's really to give us some ideas now. What are we going to do about that? If we've decided we need to have a spiritual experience, but we don't believe in God, or what about if we're being convinced, like the guy that went to see Carl Jung, that basically after Carl Jung said to him, you need to have a spiritual experience, and he said, yeah, but I already believe in God. And Carl Jung said to him, well, I'm sorry, but in your case, it doesn't spell the necessary spiritual experience. Well, that's what this book, this chapter is about. This is about opening up our minds to the idea of having a spiritual experience. And in Bill's story, which we didn't have time to finish too much of it, but one of the things that you'll find in italicized writing at Bill's story is the thing that broke the ice for him, the thing that really allowed him to start his spiritual experience was a simple idea that that guy brought to him, this Ebby guy that David was talking about. He brought him this simple concept. He said, you can choose your own conception of God, whichever one makes sense to you. And that was the thing that opened up Bill's mind. That's what allowed him, because he had certain prejudices against religion. That's what's, don't you love being up here at this place when you read Bill's story and it talks about that part about when he was listening to the minister way off in the hill, and me and Greg, the last time we were up here, we spotted that church up there and said, well, I bet you that's the one we heard, he heard that preacher's voice way off in the distance. Must have been at that church way up here on the top of the street. And he remembers the ideas about what the minister was saying about God and his own father's convictions about God and what he thought about religion and so forth. And he talked about all these prejudices that he had about it. And this chapter here is written by that guy that had all those prejudices against God. He wrote this chapter, We Agnostics, and he's talking about, you know, how do we open up our mind to this idea of God? How do we become open to do this? You know, and he talks in here, there's a sentence in We Agnostics about a simple question that we have to ask ourselves, which is really pertaining to this step two. And this is the simple question that we have to ask. Over on page 47, it says, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? And the promise is, it says, as soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, then we emphatically assure him he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. And David and I will be talking about, just, and we'll make reference it at any rate, it's referenced in the book, talking about a spiritual structure that's that we're going to build, which is our pathway to freedom, to recover from alcoholism. And the cornerstone, or the foundation of this spiritual structure, is going to be this idea, is either we're willing to believe in God, or that we do believe that God, or a power greater than ourselves, can in fact restore us to sanity. And in this chapter, I find a lot of different things that I think were ideas that perhaps Phil Wilson found that opened his mind towards God. There's a lot of different words for God in here that we find, a lot of capitalized words within this chapter. On page 46 right here, it talks about a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe. And he refers to God in a number of different ways. It says back on page 45 that the word God is brought up, and sometimes a particular idea of him is brought up. But those are the things that we're trying to get over. Those are the things that we're trying to be open-minded about, is whatever conception we have of God, we need to be a bit open-minded. It talks about how, you know, one of the lines in here that I like is one about logic on page 53. It says, logic is great stuff. We liked it. We still like it. It is not by chance that we are given the power to reason, to examine the evidence of our own senses, and to draw conclusions. That is one of man's magnificent attributes. And that was one of the things that I had that a little bit backwards in my life, because I thought that logic was the end of all. I thought that over here, that it talks about on page 49, it says, instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents and spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation, we agnostics and atheists chose to believe that our human intelligence was the last word, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end of it all. Rather vain of us, wasn't it? And that's the way I look at it now. I can see back and see just how vain I was, because that's what that logical thinking that I had was, that my human intelligence and so forth would, not only my own, of course, but the intelligence of other humans would finally solve all the questions. And I didn't have a lot of information, which was one of my strong points, is that I didn't really have to learn everything. I could decide on my own what was true and which wasn't. I had that ability to just know what other people were thinking. That was one of the gifts that I had, too. I seemed to be able to tell exactly what other people were thinking, and I knew how people that I hadn't even met, how they thought. And I remember thinking once that, you know, how other people might view creation, or might view God or spirit of the universe or whatever it is. I thought, well, they're really educated people. They know damn right well there's no God. You know, they know it. And guys like Einstein, they know what the scoop is, and they know that certainly science will prove the whole deal. That's the way I looked at it. And it talks about in here somehow how we would, when we talked about other people, how they had this religious idea that, you know, my only response to them was to cynically dissect what they were talking about. And that's what I used to do. Down in Boston, we have a columnist named Howie Carr. And I remember he used to write this article about, once in a while, about, it was this a religious movement called PTL, which was Praise the Lord or something. It was a television evangelistic movement and so forth. And he would make fun of it. He would call it past the loop ministry and so forth. And I would just eat it up. I mean, and whenever I saw anything negative about a religion, no matter what it was, I just latched on to it. Those are the things that I believe. But I made all this up in my own mind. And my way of poking fun of people with religious ideas or their spirituality was, very limited information. Most of it all made up in my own, deciding like what I thought Einstein thought. You know, I have like one of my favorite quotes today that I have, that not my quote, but Einstein's quote. I have it hanging up in my room. It said, this is what Einstein said, is that to know the thoughts of God is the only important thing. The rest are just details. And that's the guy that I would have assumed was an atheist. And that's what he thought, was to know God's thoughts. And that's what we at Alcoholics Anonymous, that's really our whole mission in life, is to only to know what God's thoughts are. That's all we need to know to be recovered alcoholics, is, you know, later on we'll talk about inquiring about knowledge of His will for us. That's all we need to know. And that's actually what Einstein had come to terms with and knew that. But my whole prejudice against the whole thing didn't allow that. And I was so prejudiced and so far removed from reality, thinking that my own human intelligence was the end of it. I can remember being at my friend's wedding. My roommate, he asked me to be his best man at his wedding and so forth, and I remember how horrified I was at that whole idea. Is that when he asked me, I thought, well, for Christ's sake, after everything I've done for him, now he wants me to do this too, you know? And later on, I had found out, too, how he was so concerned about who he should ask for his best man and so forth. He asked a friend about how you make the selection, and the friend said, well, you should pick somebody who you really trust, somebody you like their character, and you think they'll be there in the long run for you and so forth. And he really went into this long decision about picking the right person. And then he asked me, and my immediate reaction is, well, for Christ's sake, now he wants me to do this on top of everything else. So, I mean, that's a sick, diseased mind that thinks that way. But that's the way I was. And the only thing I could think of, and being an alcoholic, active alcoholic at the time, getting ready to do the toast at the wedding, you know, for months, I'm thinking at the bar stool, what a great job I'm going to do. I'm thinking I'm gonna get these nice Gaelic sayings that'll impress his grandparents and so forth like that. And I thought about all this stuff, but then when the day came to have the wedding, I just had to drink about a quart of scotch just to get up in front of the crowd to say the toast. And I don't even know what I said, but it was no more than about four words, and I was like ready to die after that. But after getting loosened up like this, I had met this minister that married him, and that's the story I just want to get around to, is I met the minister that married him and his wife, and at the reception later on, this guy seemed like a nice enough chap, and I thought, you know, I'd like to just grab this guy and get him to one side. You know, I had had a few cocktails, and I said maybe he had had one or two, and I knew that once you had a few drinks in you, you could really talk turkey and get the truth out of somebody, you know? So I sat this guy down, just him and I, and I said to him, I said, you know, I'd like to ask you a question. And I said, and it won't go any further than me either. I said, just between you and me, I said, do you really believe that there's a God that you pray to and he guides you and you follow? And he looked at me and he said, yes, Brian, I do believe that. And I thought to myself, well, for Christ's sake, what did I expect? You know? Did I expect him to tell the truth? You know, they're like, I figured, well, they're like doctors. They'll all stick together, all the religious people. You know, so I just walked away from that, not even believing that. So for me to be feeling the way I do about God today, you know, something had to happen. And it was that open-mindedness that took place by being part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Back the last page on page 29 of There Is a Solution, one just a quick thing I didn't get a chance to get to right there, it says, talks about on the top of the page, we actually have this in our group conscience statement down in Marshfield, talking about that the solution is in this book. It says, further on, clear-cut directions are showing how we recovered. And then these are followed by 43 personal experiences. It says, each individual in the 43 stories in the back of this book describes in his own language and from his own point of view how he established his relationship with God. And that's what happened to me by going to a lot of AA meetings and by listening to people, that eventually what happened to me is that I started to believe that the people that were speaking at meetings believed. That was a giant step for me. And then what happened to me one weekend is I went on a retreat. It was a Matt Talbot retreat. And on this retreat, there was this extremely spiritual man. And he opened the retreat up and he said, we're on very spiritual ground. And he said, there's going to be a lot of healing on this weekend. He said, I can feel it. I can sense it. I know that this is going to be a very powerful and healing weekend. And when he was saying these words, I had goosebumps. I felt really, really, really good. You know, I felt really warm inside. A feeling I'd felt many times at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and listening to somebody tell their story, something that was very moving. I'd just really feel good. And noticed that every time I went to an AA meeting, no matter what kind it was, if I stayed for the whole meeting, I always felt better afterwards than I did before I went to the meeting. So at this retreat, they gave you an opportunity to sign up and have some private time with this retreat master. And I thought it was a requirement. I never would have signed up for it if I thought it was optional. I just went to get it out of the way real quick. And I remember going up and sitting down with this guy, And I said, well, I don't know what we're going to talk about. I don't really believe in God. And he said, well, what do you believe in, Brian? And I told him the story about, I said, you know, the thing I do believe is like the feelings I have, like when I heard you speak and how I just like felt really warm inside and felt good and so forth and how I felt at AA meetings. And he said, well, Brian, that's God. And I went, really? That's God? I've felt the presence of God? That's how God feels? And he said, yeah. And this guy had been a priest for 35 years. I figured he must know what he's talking about. So I left that weekend thinking, geez, I've experienced God then. I've felt the presence of God. And then from that point on, that's when my open-mindedness started. And that's when I was able to start listening to some of the things that were in this chapter, We Agnostics, about being open-minded. And that idea about the logic being great stuff, that's what happened to me in this process. It was a matter of me basically examining the evidence of my own senses and drawing conclusions about the evidence of those senses. And that's how my spiritual experience, my awakening took place, was by that simple process of actually logically analyzing and examining the evidence of my own senses, the reactions, the things that started to take place. The times when I first took this real flimsy read that it talked about earlier in the book, the thing that's now turned out to be the powerful and loving hand of God. That flimsy read for me was that, you know, breaking out to that man and telling him that. And then when he said that, then I basically, the very first time I said, I had a difficult decision coming up in my life, and I asked God that night, I said, okay, God, guide me. Let me know what knowledge of your will for me is. And a friend of mine had given me some book, a daily meditation book, and I read that book the next morning thinking that, you know, maybe I'll have some message in here about this decision. And that morning I read it. And it was a message about that day. And I kept looking at it. I said, wow, how could that be? How could that be arranged? And then I started like I'm questioning God. Well, how can that work? How, the book's already been printed. How can he work like that? How can that happen? And you know what? I still don't have any idea. And I don't think I need to know. But all I know is that message, I know somehow or other that was from God to me. That message that guided me that day. And I've been able to keep doing that same procedure. And what am I doing here, David? Are we getting close?
For 5 minutes.
And what happened here on page 55 is one of my favorite parts of this story right here, We Agnostics, this chapter. It tells me a little bit about, even though I can choose any conception of God I want, there's kind of a conception in a way that's within this book. And one of the things it tells me here is something I've found to be true now and later. It says that actually, you know, we're fooling ourselves. It says, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. Faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that faith in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was part of our makeup just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. And that was so with me. That's where I found God. I remember that night I got arrested. the night that I was in the automobile accident. I got arrested, and I was in the jail that night, and they were booking me. And I remember one thing, they were fingerprinting me. And I remembered, you know, here I get arrested for driving under, and so what if I had a little marijuana with me? I mean, it was just for, there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, yeah, I had a half a gram of coke in my wallet, but I mean, it was just for, you know. So the guy's fingerprinting me. And I said, why are you fingerprinting me? And he said, these fingerprints go to the FBI. I said, the FBI? I said, I'm a good guy. I haven't done anything wrong. Why would you be sending my fingerprints to the FBI? It was a mystery to me what was going on. But I started to really get sober at that point, like, whoa, there's something bad going on. And I ended up being then in the jail, you know, all alone by myself. And I was already finding one or two things to be grateful for because I couldn't see the cell on either side of me. But I saw their dungarees, their boots, and their shirts, and their underpants were out in the hallway in front of their cells. So I thought one thing, well, I'm not going to start any trouble, that's for damn sure, because it was cold enough in that cell without being in there naked. But while I was in there, and I saw my whole life, like, folding up before my eyes, I sat in that cell, and I said, please help me, please help me. And that's an atheist doing that, a guy that doesn't believe in God. So what that tells me is that deep down inside of me is the fundamental idea of God. It was already there. It was part of my makeup. It's instinctual for me as a human being to go to my Creator in my hour of need. And that's what happened. From that point on, things started happening from that first accident. I remember going to my car the next day. 2 days later with my dad, my poor 60-something-year-old father. I mean, he's going to my car, and he looks at this wrecked, just twisted-up pretzel. You know, it was a $25,000 sedan. Now it was just a twisted piece of metal, and I had to get a couple of things out of it. And he looked at it, and this is my dad, the atheist. And he looked at the car, and I was looking at it. And he said to me, he said, Brian, he said, you know, maybe there is a God. And it was just what I was thinking. That same thought was in my head. I'm thinking, maybe there is a God. And that when he said that, I just got chills when he said that. And, you know, from that point, I had my eyes open. I was being open-minded about this idea, and that's what made me start listening a little bit at meetings and start hearing people. And eventually, I heard somebody. I liked their conception of God. And then I did this process, which, as we pointed out in the beginning of this chapter, is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. The last part of this page here, page 57, it talks about the promises of this thing. It talks about this person that once he decided he'd make these decisions, like the guy that said, you know, he had this revelation on 56, he said, who are you to say there is no God? You know, that's what happened to him. That's what opened his mind. He said, who am I to say there is no God? And then it says the man recounts that he tumbled out of bed, and within a few seconds he was overwhelmed by the conviction of the presence of God. It poured over him and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great flooded tide. The barriers that he had built up were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his Creator. Thus, his cornerstone was fixed in place. No later vicissitude has shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away. 57, God had restored his sanity. And then it says, that this has happened to us all. God has restored us all to our right man, to our right minds. To this man, his revelation was sudden. My experience that was similar to that didn't happen until I did my fifth step. But it doesn't matter. I guarantee you that if you do this, if you follow the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says it right here. It says, some of us grow into it more slowly, but he has come to all who have earnestly sought him. And then look, Bill thought this sentence was so important, it's a whole paragraph. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. And that's how simple this is. It's a matter of just drawing ourselves to him, and you will come into the conscious awareness of the presence of God that'll hopefully become the most important thing in your life.
I like when Brian tells that story about at the retreat. And when we talk about we agnostics, it brings that sense of peace over me and gets me focused on just what is important in my life. Problem was is that I had never experienced that in my life. The only thing I knew was the way I had run my life, which caused, first of all, my insanity was my thinking, and then ended up causing all my problems in life, all my excuses for why my life was miserable. That feeling that Brian's talking about is, I call it today, is, you know, I used to have an obsession for alcohol, and today I have an obsession for the constant presence of God throughout my whole day in my life, which is the gift of that is constant peace and serenity. You know, there, all the problems that I thought I had in my life that I thought were problems just aren't problems today. When I see that any situation can go on in my life and know that they're going to be okay and that's the way they're supposed to be, is one of the thoughts I use all day long to remind me what's important in my life. How it works. You know, we both laid out information that we need to draw on to make a conclusion. I really don't think I've ever known an alcoholic that was able to jump right to step three, you know, and make that honest decision. And I think it mostly was because of the inability to differentiate the truth and the false. So, you know, in the chapters before, it says, you know, if our experience has shown you anything, you know. So in other words, we've been drawing on, you know, what we do is share our experience. What the book does is share its experience. And again, to help us come to two conclusions. In that, we need, again, to make step three. But I want to read the beginning of the chapter before we get to the actual discussion of step three. It's very interesting reading this chapter and going through and talking about some of the words. Matter of fact, quite a few of the words. How it works. The first word is rarely. You know, that's almost never. Have we seen a person fail? In other words, have this not work, who has thoroughly, through to completion, you know, if we want to call it a completeness without deleting things, followed our path. And their path is what they have laid out in this book as the program of attaining the spiritual experience. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. I can think back and think, probably periods in my life where I was in some of those categories. You know, I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. Well, that was most of my life. I don't know exactly whether he's talking about somebody else, but, you know, it was also, you know, I needed to be brought to my knees through enough pain before I was willing to get honest enough and throw away my constitution and become willing to, as Brian was just talking about, begin to be honest with myself and begin to start to look at things from a different perspective. So our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. That's, again, the 12th step, what you gain somebody's confidence. If you have decided what you want, you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. Then you are ready to take certain steps. Now it's starting to go, are you ready to make a decision? It's almost like, you know, we have a step 6 and we have a step 8. You know, these are preparation steps. Well, this is almost like another step, you know, saying, are you ready to make a decision? Let's review, you know, what it is, you know, what your problem is. And that's where they end with the three pertinent ideas. So you need to start asking yourself, you know, am I ready? Do I understand why I'm going to make a decision here? Because some of these we balked, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. And just what the beginning of this chapter says is that, you know, I decided to do what they did because it's been laid out that it's worked over and over and over. And in the book it says you cannot fail with this attitude. So at that point I decided that no, I wasn't going to try, so I continued on and the reading says, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. Again, talking about the thoroughness of when we go through this conversion process, half measures avail us nothing. You know, I can't go in there and take this cafeteria style. Maybe somebody could, but I was convinced at this point I couldn't. I was willing to just totally give up and do whatever they told me to do. 2 years before that, I wasn't. I don't know how that switch got turned, you know. I know there was more pain, but in any case, because half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. And this is where I made my decision really. It says, we asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, admitting to God, excuse me. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. You know, they do sound rather drastic as you read them. And I remember when I came in here, you know, these things seemed ridiculous. And as Brian said, you know, none of us like the searching, the self-searching, the leveling of our pride. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was just full of fear. I was fear. And so when I started these things I had to do, you know, it was, no way. I'm taking them cafeteria style. I'll do some of them, but I'm not doing all of them. You know, there was no way. I mean, one of the big ones that stood out was, there's no way I'm going to go say I'm sorry to anybody. Maybe, you know, I was still myself seeking. If I wanted something, then I would, you know. But, so what they, nicely what they tell us here is that, it says, many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. And then it calms us a little. It says, do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to spiritual progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. With that paragraph, and I didn't understand this really for a while, but I thought when I went through the 12 steps and heard people talk about having a spiritual awakening and in what they felt in their lives and the sincerity and explain their relationship with God, when I got through here, I didn't realize that this process is just designed to clear away enough so we can get to God. You know, George, who used to do this, you know, has a wonderful story about finishing this and then going out and being very, very upset because immediately he didn't react perfectly. And so, you know, that was another time at which, you know, we need the reassurance of a sponsor or of somebody else on the same path that, you know, this is normal. We're looking for spiritual progress. And the only way I can have, in my experience, was the only way I could have that spiritual progress was to first get to God. Lack of power, that was my dilemma. And I emphasize that because I've heard so many stories like that we put expectations about where we're supposed to be spiritually when I know for me, I had never been spiritual. I had no connection. So I needed to keep listening to people and use examples like this in the book. All right, so we're at the point about starting to make a decision. And these are the considerations for the conclusions we've been coming through in the beginning chapters. Our description to the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Brian very nicely explained that, and that's where we need, at this point, if we're here, we need to consider that. You know, do I possess the allergy of an alcoholic, and do I possess the insanity that precedes the first drink, the inability to not pick up the drink? And then D, probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism. You know, we've looked over and over about how we've tried to solve the problem, and the conclusions we came up with were, have another Heineken. You know, I mean, that was my conclusion too, you know. The problem would be solved some other time, or some other lie I created to, you know, conveniently forget about the pain and suffering, or whatever it was I used. I couldn't solve the problem. And then, through the experience of people who were helping me through the readings in this book, and through the experience of people at meetings, as I talked about in the preceding chapter, you know, I began to get, I call it a blind faith. I didn't believe in God, but people gave tons of reasons why I should in my situation. They give all the examples that they have, and I was confronted at that point to say, what do I do? If I want to solve the problem, then am I willing to believe in this power that is helping all these people? So the second conclusion is really that I can't solve the problem. Probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism. To relieve my alcoholism means I need to be restored to sanity. So, and then the third is that I'm accepting that there is some power and I'm willing to seek it. And it says that God could and would if he was sought. Because being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will in our life over to the care of God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run self-will can hardly be a success. At this point, we hadn't been really talking about using the word self-will a lot. And in this reading, we're starting to get introduced to the underlying causes that drove our obsession, that the excuses we used, the fears we had, the lies we told ourselves, and the misconceptions I had in life. We're going to start to look at all of these reasons because all of this stuff is the stuff that's been blocking me from God. I didn't understand this, but I could very simply understand that here I am and God's over there and there's a mountain of my stuff. Not God's stuff, not anybody else's stuff, my stuff. and that until I was willing to work at clearing that away, I was never going to get that connection that I needed. So I was willing to make that decision. But what they do is they start to give us some nice examples of some of the stuff we're going to be clearing away. And I could identify right from the start. Because the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody. Even though our motives are good, though we think, most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. He's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. I started to identify because I knew my whole life. I was convinced that if people would do what I thought, everything would just run fine. You know, I even said to my brother once, and I gave the world the benefit of the doubt, I said, you know, if people would only do what I wanted, 80% of the time, everything would just go fine. I wanted to be a little humble there. But I was absolutely convinced of that. And this is what they're talking about here, is that if my arrangements would only stay put, if people would only do as I wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. I didn't really understand that part. I mean, I always thought of myself as a real nice guy, and I did things for people because I was a nice guy. So at this point, I didn't understand that self-seeking, because I didn't understand selfishness. I didn't consider myself a selfish person. What usually happens is the show doesn't come off very well. And obviously, I mean, that's another place right here where we start to go and we start to identify what they're talking about in the book with our lives, to understand that we have these problems. Bottom of the page, our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that, we think, is the root of our troubles. That's something I was suggested I focus on definitely through this process, and I learned I need to focus on that, you know, in my daily spiritual conditioning. This selfishness and self-centeredness is driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. Again, I have to go from what I used to think, the way I perceived the world and the people in it. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, us alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there is often, seems, no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. This is the how and the why of it. Last paragraph, it says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in the drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone to the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. Again, this is just making a decision after the conclusions of saying, you know, I can't solve this problem. And then I ask myself, am I willing to pursue the solution? Which by now is evident to me what I have to do to solve this problem. But am I willing? And this, the third step promises next are what I like the way Bill did this in the book. He always gave us that reassurance of their experience to give us that little boost. to give us the strength to go on. He says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed, if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. Honestly, at that point, when in my process, I sounded real nice, just like the promises in the ninth step sound real nice. But I didn't understand them, and I never thought I would possess them. But what it did was it just let me know again that this was their experience, and it really worked for them. As Brian said, he became convinced that these people really did believe. When all his life, he knew that they really didn't. That's a big step, and that's what they're telling us here. When I got to this process, my sponsor did this, and I was at his house, and we spent the last few hours in his kitchen going over these chapters. And you know, being full of fear, I didn't know, you know, how I'm supposed to do the third step. What we typically do in our step studies, because we have sponsors in there that have gone through the steps in the big book, and those people take other people who want to go through the same process. The way we typically do it is we get down on our knees with our sponsor, and we hold hands and we say the third step prayer. Now, there aren't any requirements in here as to how to do things, but it's just something that we've accepted that we do. It's not a must, but. So when I drove into the parking lot with my sponsor to the meeting, I was just full of fear, and I know God gave me the power to just come out and say, I'm ready. I've made a decision. You know, I'd like to do the third step with you. And that was a big step for me. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. But right there, we just hopped out of his car right in the parking lot and found a beautiful night sky, you know, and we got down on our knees and held hands, and I said, so God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step. That was with my sponsor. And when I made that decision, I was able to say this prayer. And that was my relinquishing control to God. Because we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. That means, you know, without holding back anything. We want to make sure that, okay, we're going to do the best of our ability not to run the show anymore. You know, I was told you can't expect perfection, but you got to, every time something you take back, you got to remember what you did here. And so just to jump ahead for a moment, you know, that's what I did all the way through really the rest of my steps. You know, I said this prayer over and over again. The first part of it says, I offer myself to thee. That's that, okay, I can't solve this problem. I am willing to believe that you can by building this relationship with you. And also saying, I want you to build me to the new person. Relieve me of the bondage of self. At this point, I didn't understand that much about my selfishness and how that was the real problem. I saw enough of it, in the preceding chapter, and I saw that my thinking was a problem, and I was told self is your self-will comes from your thinking. So I could identify enough of that. And I know that's what I needed to be relieved of, the bondage of me. Of course I wanted him to take away my difficulties. I didn't really understand what my difficulties were. At this point, this is pre-inventory, so I had no idea. I mean, I started to understand what my problem in my thinking was a little bit. So, but I wanted my difficulties taken away, and I was willing to go to any lengths to do that. And then the last part of it is, and I didn't really focus on this for quite a while, but, you know, this is all about helping other alcoholics. You know, that my experience, my spiritual awakening, I can carry this message to another alcoholic and help them to find God also. The bottom of the page, it says, this was only the beginning. Though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a great one, was felt at once. I would say maybe half to three-quarters of the people really can explain a feeling. I had a feeling that I wasn't walking into that meeting. We were in the back of the building, and we said that prayer, and I got up, and it was like I floated into the meeting. It's similar to feeling with Brian. It was different than I had ever had. One of the things Bill talks about, he even put the spiritual tendencies in the back of the book, is that the spiritual awakening is really a small part of our spiritual growth. Their spiritual experience is an immediate God consciousness. So, you know, I believe that that was one of those. That was a feeling I had never had before. Same thing when Brian talked about that first time he really thought, that's God. And so that's what I keep adding up. And so, of course, as I continue to grow in my spiritual life, I keep learning and feeling and believing things differently than I ever did before. But this was the beginning, and this is one of the first real feelings that I had about the willingness to seek God, and this is one of the first feelings I had that something was different. And for the first time in my life, that I had really found the solution that I had been looking for my whole life. So, going into the fourth step, but actually still connected in the third step, as it says, next we launched out on a vigorous course of action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted, though our decision was a vital and crucial step. So I'll stop there, but the point is that the old analogy of three frogs sitting on a log, you know, one decides to jump off. You know, how many are left? Well, there's three. You know, he only decided to jump off. He didn't take any action necessary to jump off. Now, I made decisions my whole life, and most of the time never followed them up. When in our examples, in the examples in the book, you know, about our thinking about our drinking, we made a decision the next day we're going to do it differently, and we ended up not doing it, you know, because we didn't take up the action, you know. But I think what we're going to do is end there. We've got a couple minutes. If anybody's got any questions, that we were going to open it up for maybe 5 minutes. All right, everybody, I hope you had a good lunch. One of the things I just wanted to talk about to begin with is the stuff in your folder you were given. Some of them are just interesting things that both Brian and I had. One of them was on fear, and then helping us just identify things about the problem and the solution that Brian had written up. Then there's the readings on each step, where they are located, as our groups read them. Then there's a page on just the 12 steps, but also with a couple of quotes by Bill. And then, as I was talking about the spiritual experience that is in the back of your books and the appendices, it's just, I think it's real important for especially people starting out to understand what Bill had to say about that compared to his experience. And then the last thing was the fourth step papers that we have. We kept this as close to, you know, exactly what's in the book, just so it can help you identify when you take it home where all this stuff is in the book. And this is just how we went about doing our process. So, there are three meeting list papers up here. Actually, somebody came up with an updated version of it. So, there's three of them up here. I'm going to make copies and have more of them up here for tomorrow morning, because they include more of New Hampshire and closer to here than we had on our list. So, and the last thing was, if people had signed up for a meeting with us tonight at 7 p.m. on the blue sheet, I assumed that was our list. I didn't see the top of the page. Make sure you come up and sign the white page, you know, or you can just show up tonight. We'll be there anyway. So, you know, we ended up a third step. We made a decision, and now we really got to take the first action. You know, since we've made a decision, and that action is followed up in the four-step inventory, which Brian's going to start us off on. Brian?
Hello, everybody. Brian, an alcoholic.
Hey, Brian.
Had a really nice lunch. Hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. I think the best part about it is just seeing all the love and care that goes into that lunch, the way they're preparing it. I know when I went in for my breakfast this morning, I looked over and saw them cutting up the pieces of pheasant, and I thought, I thought it was perhaps sausages for breakfast. That's what I was thinking, but they're working on lunch already, so I know they put a lot of care and stuff, and it was very enjoyable having it. I hope everybody else enjoyed it as well. So let's see now. We're on the fourth step. I'm going to start talking about it. And the way we view this fourth step, the way we interpret the way the instructions are in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it appears to us that the fourth step is divided into basically three different categories. The first category being resentment, and then the second category being fear, and the third category being sex. So I'm going to start by the first portion of the fourth step, which is the resentment section. And I can remember first being at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings when I would look at the list of the steps that were hanging from the curtain, or whatever you call it, the pull-down sheet that had the steps listed. And I remember I would read, you know, the fourth step, which says, taking a fearless and moral inventory of ourselves. And I'd look at that, and I'd be sitting at the meeting, and I'd read that, and I'd think, so I'd spend a couple of minutes, I'd be thinking back through my life a little bit. I'd say, well, that doesn't seem that tough, you know. And I pretty much thought I'd been done with it when I did that. You know, it took me probably about 5 minutes to do my fearless and moral inventory, until I got a sponsor that had followed the directions in the big book, and that sponsor started walking me through the instructions in here and how we went through it. And then I found that it was going to be a little more involved than what I had originally envisioned. So it starts on page 64 is where we start talking about the inventory. It starts with the second paragraph. It says, therefore, we started upon our personal inventory. And just to recap for a second, the reason that I was doing my personal inventory is essentially I didn't have any choice at this point, because I had already done my third step. And David was dealing, when he talked about that third step, he talked about the selfishness and so forth, the root of our problem, and the first requirement is that we have to see that selfishness, self-will, run riot is the problem. And I got to be honest with you, when I was sitting down with my sponsor and talking about that, I did not see selfishness as my problem. You know, when he was talking to me about that, I was looking at him, and I said to myself in my mind, I said, I believe selfishness was your problem, but I think you're going to be pretty surprised when you find out just how unselfish I am. So I really didn't see that I was going to run into this difficulty when he talked about, you know, dishonesty and fear. I thought that, you know, by the time we were done with this thing, he was going to be quite surprised to find out that I was, in fact, very unselfish, very honest, and so forth and so on. That's not what happened, but that was my idea at that time when we were sitting together. So what he said, well, will you be willing, Brian, if you do this work, will you be willing, will you be open-minded to accept if this is shown to you, if you developing this relationship with God, because he told me when we were doing this third step together, he said, Brian, you're not doing this third step with me so that you and I can develop a relationship together. He said that you're doing this third step, you're making a commitment to God to do the rest of the program. That's what I was doing. That's the decision I made, is to do a fourth step, a fifth step, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, 12th. That was the decision that I was making. And all along that, while I was writing my inventory, you know, that third step said, you know, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Now I was happy to do that, to tell you the truth. That seemed like a very okay thing to do, to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. But the problem presented that was presented to me really was, how do I do that? You know, what is God's will for me? And what is my will? So how do I turn my life and my will over? Sure, I'm willing to follow God's direction, but what is it? You know, what is it that God wishes me to do? And my sponsor said, well, according to the way this third step is written, it's telling us here that our next step after making this decision is to launch out on this course of vigorous action, the first step of which is the house cleaning. So he said, you could be pretty well assured that if you're working on your inventory, if you're working on your fourth step, then you are then doing God's will. That's what God wants you to do, is to work on this inventory, to take care of that inventory. So I was pretty well convinced that whole business of making the decision was that I was going to do this. I wrestled with this for 2 months before I said, yes, I'm going to do it, because I had heard a lot of things said about what could possibly be in this inventory. I remember even going way back before I got to the Big Book Step Study group, this young man that was a friend of mine had brought me to another 12-step meeting, and he's the one that suggested to me, you need to do, he actually heard me speak at the meeting for a few minutes. He said, Brian, if you did these steps, he said, you could help a lot of people. And I thought, well, that sounds like a nice idea. I wanted to help people, actually quite amazed that nobody had asked me to be their sponsor already, because I was so clever and knew everything. I really was a bit surprised that nobody had come to me already. So I said, well, how do you do the steps then? He says, well, you got to take a written inventory. And I said, written, huh? I said, it doesn't say anything like that in the book. It doesn't say, you know, in the list, because I don't know about the Big Book at this point. I'm just looking at the list on the wall, take a fearless and moral inventory. And he says, well, he said, Brian, he says, I have to really be careful of my language here. He said that it will include anything from stealing money from your mother. We were alone in the car when he said this to me, this honest guy. Anything from stealing money from your mother to, let's just say, doing something with a vacuum cleaner. That I'll just tell you that it didn't pertain to the resentment part of the step, and it didn't pertain to the fear part of the step. So when he said that, I sat in the car and I thought, wow, how does this guy know stuff about, like, know things about me like that? So I didn't say anything. The next thing I said was, I said, so, well, how do you do a written fourth step then? And those were just some of the things that I was a little bit nervous about working on. So when I started this business with my sponsor and he wanted to tell me how to go about writing this fourth step, he said that we're just going to follow some very simple, clear-cut directions that are in the book. They're the very same directions that he went over with his sponsor, and he said, let's see what we're going to do here. And in the first paragraph, it starts off by telling, like, why we're going to take the inventory.
It says, a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged and unsaleable goods and to get rid of them promptly without regret. If the owner of a business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. And that made perfect sense to me because I had been, in some years previous to meeting my sponsor, I had had this position where I was a plant manager of a small manufacturing company that had been losing money for two or three years in a row until I took over this position. And one of the things they made Christmas tree ornaments and tree tops. It was a small company, about 70 people, and about a $1 million operation is what they had. And what happened there was that they had this huge, huge supply of corrugated cardboard cartons and these paper folding boxes that they had had from previous issues of the ornaments, and they were brand new. They had never been touched. But each year they changed their positioning of the ornaments, the style, and so forth, and each set of these boxes was designed to just fit a special size. So they had a building that was like the size of the Wilson House, and it was filled almost three-quarters of the way with these boxes that they would never use. And I said to them, you know, we have to get rid of these things. And he said, well, I can't because they represent $150,000 to $200,000 on the books. And I thought, I didn't know anything about accounting at the time, but I knew one thing, they were fooling themselves about values, because these things were worth nothing. We were storing product out in the outside, renting trailers to put finished goods in, and I finally convinced them that they were fooling themselves about the value of these boxes, and they decided to get rid of them. They just sold them to somebody that gave them pennies on a dollar or whatever you call that, but they got rid of them for next to nothing. And what happened as a result of that, it just freed up the entire manufacturing floor. Everybody was able to work smoothly and ended up making a profit. And that was one of the major reasons we did, is because they took an inventory, but they were holding on to some of the worst items in stock. And we got rid of those things. So this whole business about making a personal inventory about myself makes a lot of sense. If I'm believing a lot of lies about my past, and that's what happened, starting with the lie that I have that precedes the first drink. What I found out later on in going through this, there's a lot of other lies that I've been telling myself my entire life. And this is what this inventory was all about. It was finding out what I've got deep down inside of me, keeping hold of the things that are good, and then getting rid of the other things. And that's what it tells us. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly, we searched out our flaws and our makeup, which had caused our failure, and then being convinced that self manifested in various ways, which defeated us, then now we consider its common manifestations. And here it says, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And it says, this is interesting, the next sentence it says, resentment, it says, from it stem all forms of spiritual disease, which I find that to be very interesting, that all forms of spiritual disease stem from resentment. The thing that the alcoholic, you remember, we're after a spiritual experience. That's what we need to recover from alcoholism. And one of the things that all spiritual disease stem from is resentment. And that's why it ends up being the number one offender that we have to get rid of at all cost. So it says, it tells us that we've been mentally and physically ill, but we have also been spiritually sick. And when the spiritual malady is overcome, this is interesting, this is a little bit different order than I had heard. It says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, then we straighten out mentally and physically. It's not the other way. Some people say, you know, come here, get physically sober for a while, stay around for a few years, get mentally straightened out, and then maybe, you know, down the road, you can work on the spirituality. Well, actually, in the book that contains the program of recovery, it says the opposite. It says work on the spiritual malady first, then straighten out mentally and physically. So now it says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. See, if that young friend of mine sitting in the car with me, if he had known what this book said, he wouldn't have had to embarrass me like that. He could have just said, it says right here on page 64 about we do a written inventory. It says right here, we set them on paper. And then my sponsor went over this. He said, okay. He said, now the next sentence says, we listed people, institutions, or principals with whom we were angry. And he said, we're going to stop right there. That's as far as we're going right now, is we're just going to stop at that sentence, that we list people, institutions, or principals with whom we're angry. And then he started telling me how I was going to do this. He said, you can do whatever you want. He says, you're going to need some notebooks. That's what most people use. Get a notebook. Get a pen. It doesn't matter what kind of notebook you get. I happened to get, I went to Staples and got a whole batch of notebooks. It was, you know, like a whole package of them. I had no idea what was going to happen, but I liked being prepared. So I got a whole bunch of single subject notebooks, and I brought them home. And so he told me to go about now doing this first part. He says, now before you start, he said, I'd like you to go home, get your dictionary, and look up the definition of angry, because you're going to be writing a list of people that you're angry at. So he says, I think it would be interesting to know for you to know what angry means. So I got that dictionary and I looked it up, and I thought, well, that's silly enough. I know what angry is. But I went home and I looked it up anyway, and what I found out was, it wasn't exactly what I, if you had asked me what angry and I told you the definition, I don't think I would have had what was in Webster's. And it just says, a strong feeling of displeasure. And I thought, that's interesting. Not exactly what I thought, but I can work with that. You know, that helps me to understand what angry is. So then he started giving me the instructions on how to go about doing this. He said, now this third step is directly tied in with your inventory. He said, this is about you and God. You're going to be developing a relationship with God. And he said, you're going to be working on this inventory with God. So he said, what you want to do is when you get home, get to a place that you can be by yourself, have no radio on, no television on, be by yourself, say the third step prayer, and ask God to help you do this work. And then he said, then you're going to sit down, and like it says here in the book, it says, we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. I'm taking that sentence from the bottom of 65. So he said, that's what you're going to do. You're going to start with your present life, what's going on right now all around you, and you're going to start thinking about each person that you know in your life. And when you bring that person's picture into your mind and their name, and you can say that at some time you were angry, then you're going to put that name on your list. And then you're going to think about the next person and the next person. Well, it didn't take me long to figure out who I was going to write down first. It was my father's name went right on the list. But even as simple as that instruction seems to be, that I was just to go home and make a list of people, I'll tell you, I had so much fear at the time that what I ended up doing is I went home that night and I started on this, I had about 9 pages on my father of what his problem was. And when I was all done with him, I went into what my mother's problem was. And when I was all done with her, I started on my brother. So I had about 20 pages of information, and when I went next Thursday to the meeting, I saw my sponsor. He said, so how did your writing go? And I said, oh, pretty good, and I started telling him what I had done. And he looked at me and he said, I told you just to write the names. And I said, just the names? He said, yeah, just the names. And I thought, didn't even, and I looked at the thing again, and of course that's what it says. So I said, just mother, father, brother, and he says, yeah, that's all. So I went back and I had to start all over again, and I started making that list of names, and I started going back through my life in doing this.
And he told me how important this was to tie God into the picture. So he said, each time you do this writing, when you get all by yourself, he said, I want you to make sure. David mentioned getting on your knees, doing the third step prayer. A lot of us do that. And I think one of the reasons is in the original manuscript, when you read that, that's what they did, is they got on their knees and did it. And I guess I'm just kind of a fundamentalist at heart and like to do it that way. So I just made the assumption that when I got home, I should get on my knees. Now, I don't know if you should or you shouldn't. All I can tell you is that I did. I got on my knees. And for some reason, that was the first time in my life I'd ever been on my knees to say a prayer. And all I can tell you, at the time, it seemed to help me. I don't know. Maybe it didn't help me. Maybe it wouldn't make any difference. But all I can tell you is I did get on my knees, and I said the third step prayer, and I asked God to help me with this list. And I started going back through my life and thinking of different people. I started thinking about different job situations. I would take the company I was working at now, and I would think about all the different companies that we interrelate with. I would think about all my customers. And as I brought each person's name into my mind, I would think about that person and think, you know, had I ever been angry? Because it says we make a list. It says we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. That's how my sponsor explained that. So I remember, like, I didn't really want to write my mother's name on the list.
And that concludes tape number 2, the Big Book Experience.